Chapter 10, Near Honolulu Harbor. Thomas hit the water feet first and immediately began kicking to propel himself upwards. When his head broke the surface 5 feet from the starboard bow of the Wilhelm, he began to tread water and look around. 20 feet above him, the captain was leaning over the railing. Schmidt made brief eye contact and then turned and walked away. He had been dumped overboard like a sack of garbage. But this was not the time to try to figure out why. When the Wilhelm's engines fired up and its 7-foot propeller began to churn, it would suck him in and chop him into shark bait. He turned in the water and looked towards land, where he could make out a thicket of schooner masts and the tops of several buildings, including a church spire. Craggy mountain peaks dominated the horizon, running north to south on the eastern side of Honolulu. The Wilhelm's quartermaster, who was something of an amateur geologist and naturalist, had told Thomas that Oahu's Ko'olau Range wasn't really a mountain range in the usual sense, because it had originally formed as a single volcanic mountain. What we see today is just the western half of the original volcano that remained after the eastern half tumbled into the oceans millions of years ago, he said. They form Oahu's windward coast, rising high behind the leeward-facing town of Honolulu. If he swam towards the Ko'olau, Thomas knew, it would be impossible for him to stray off course. Then a voice called out,
"Colonel! Thomas, up here!"
He looked up to see Stoch, who was resting a large pouch on the railing where the captain had stood a moment before.
"Catch!"
shouted Stuck as he tossed down the bag. Thomas swam a few feet and grabbed the pouch by its strap. It was thick, yellow-brown, and appeared to be made of waterproof material.
"Seal skin!" yelled Stuck. "There's a fresh set of clothing, a pair of boots and shaving gear inside, and the men took up a collection and raised 100 American to help you get started in Honolulu."
Thomas pulled the strap over his shoulder and touched his hand to his forehead in salute. Considering Captain Schmidt's limited options for dealing with his stowaway, tossing the problem over the side was probably the best solution to the German naval officer's dilemma. If he survived the swim to shore, the captain could simply shrug his shoulders and tell the authorities that no one should have been surprised that his stowaway chose to risk life in the open water rather than face possible imprisonment or death. And if the sharks got him before he reached land, so much the better. The sea would have rendered her own justice, and there would be no need for further investigation. Thomas had to admit, it was quite a neat solution. Stuck said there were boots inside the bag, so he pulled one leg at a time to the surface, slipped off the pair he was wearing, and watched as they slowly drifted to the bottom. Then he leaned forward in the water and began to swim towards the harbor. The wind was soft, and the warm, gentle ocean swells were drifting in the direction he was going. With luck, he would make land in under an hour.
"One last thing, Colonel,"
Stuck shouted.
"Keep to your right as you get to the harbor. The first building you will see will be on a small sand islet on your left. Avoid the place. It's called Quarantine Island, built for debris and piled up when they dredged the harbor. It's used to isolate ships that carry contagious diseases. If you go ashore there, they will keep you in isolation for a month. Viel Glück!"
Thomas raised his hand out of the water and waved behind his head. Viel Glück again. After a week working and sharing meals with the German crew, he knew it really did mean good luck. The morning sun was warm for February, at least compared to what he was used to in San Francisco. It also felt more intense than he had ever experienced, no doubt because the Hawaiian Islands were closer to the equator and the angle of the sun was correspondingly steeper. The air was perfumed with the musty aroma of seaweed and the scent of mast plants and trees on the island rising out of the sea in front of him. And he felt strangely invigorated, despite his circumstances. He wasn't worried about having to swim nearly a mile to land. The hard physical labor he had been doing on board the Wilhelm had helped to prepare him for this exertion. Each time an incoming swell raised him up, he could make out more details along the coastline, A half dozen schooners sat at anchor in the harbor, with several more lined up along a row of wharfs built parallel to the land. Two piers jutted out into the water near a floating lighthouse and a buoy, and he could see a gang of stevedores offloading crates from one of the parked schooners. The way the men carried the boxes reminded him of Henri Lavelle's employees, who slung 132-pound burlap bags filled with South American coffee beans over their shoulders and carried them from the ship's hold to Lavelle's dockside warehouse in New Orleans. A twinge coursed through his leg at the thought of Lavelle. The aristocratic planter merchant was a better shot than Thomas, and, as it happened also, a better judge of women. The crack of a flintlock pistol on the mossy bank of the creek behind Lavelle's mansion proved both those points. Thomas would never forget the oppressive thickness of the bayou air, the clouds slipping across the bright yellow moon above the cypress trees, or the surprise he felt when Lavelle's pistol ball tore into his leg and spun him to the ground. And he would always remember the expression that crossed Delphine's face as he crumpled to the ground. "I've made my choice," her eyes said, "and it's not you." A trio of gulls swooped low over his head, and a long, dark shadow slid through the blue water a few feet beneath him. Shark or dolphin? If he continued to stew in memories of Lavelle and Delphine, the shark might be his preferred choice for a swimming partner. He paused for a moment to switch the sealskin satchel to his left shoulder. As he treaded water, he noticed how clear the ocean had become. He could make out his feet now, and dark clusters of something perhaps coral or rocks on the seabed, 20 or 30 feet below. Ahead, to his left, was the sand island Stoch had warned him about. He could also make out the top of a rock jetty that extended halfway across the harbor entrance, and he could hear where lines of breakers were forming and crashing. Were they cresting over coral reefs? He couldn't be sure, but he was going to take care to swim between the lines of overlapping breakers, so he would not be flung down onto rows of razor-sharp coral fans. He swam steadily and rhythmically towards the harbor entrance. "If I ever meet Captain Stock again, I'm going to thank him for the hearty food and exercise that gave me the strength to make it this far," he thought, "right before I punch him in the nose." The sea grew warmer as he neared the shore. He swam through a patch of calm water beneath the long, rolling line of waves breaking outside the jetty. His theory that they were crashing only over areas where there was coral or rock at the sea bottom had better hold. He did not want to be pushed down by a cresting wave to whatever unpleasant surprises were waiting in the depths. He passed the jetty and veered to the right towards the first wooden pier in the harbor. Two small boats were tied to the pilings, and just beyond was the schooner being offloaded. In the distance, he could see a stretch of mud flats and a scattering of trees, warehouse buildings, and mountains. But beyond that, his view of downtown Honolulu was blocked. There were certainly no hints of the tropical paradise that Stoch had promised. No waterfalls, no flowers, and not a single exotic maiden. When he was within a few yards of the pier, he felt sandpaper scrape against his leg, and then a gray head popped up 2 feet from his face. It had cat-like whiskers, black, liquid eyes, and a wide mouth that was formed into a permanent grin. Thomas was so startled that he almost let the pouch slip off his shoulder. The seal was equally surprised. It snapped its head back, barked twice, and dipped back into the water. Thomas shook off the encounter and swam the few remaining feet to the pier. The pilings on each side were 3 feet in diameter, spaced about 20 feet apart. He made his way to the third piling, where a makeshift wooden ladder was fastened, and felt relief when his hand grasped a wooden crosspiece. He waited for a swell to raise him up a few inches, grabbed hold of a rung, and pulled himself out of the water. Until that moment, he hadn't appreciated how much the swim had taken out of him. He mustered his strength and began the slow climb to the top, 15 feet above the harbor surface. He stopped to rest a few feet below the sun-drenched pier railing, hoping no one would see him when he appeared out of the ocean like Jonah from the whale. Then he climbed the last step, and placed his hand on top of the railing, but before he could pull himself over, a huge form blotted out the sun, and a pair of giant brown hands reached down and grabbed hold of the back of his shirt. An instant later, he was lifted off the ladder and dropped in a heap on the pier's rough wood deck. Thomas held his hand up to block the sun so he could see who had picked him off the ladder as easily as if he was lifting an egg from a hen's nest. The fellow was enormous, almost as square as he was tall. He wore a loose cotton shirt and trousers, a ragged brim straw hat, and leather sandals. Standing beside him was a boy of about 10, dressed exactly like his father. The man placed his hands on his hips and looked down at Thomas, unsure of what to make of the situation. Then he wrapped a massive arm around his son's shoulders and in a serious tone said,
"The gods would make us laugh, Kou. We come to fish for Aku for tonight's supper, and instead we haul in a kanaka keokeo."
Had he just been yanked from the sea by the same tribe of cannibals that killed and boiled Captain James Cook in 1779? Thomas wondered. The man let out a great belly laugh.
"Have no fear, my friend," he said. "You are far too skinny to go into tonight's stew pot."
As his son burst into laughter, the man extended a hand and helped Thomas stand.
"Come with us to our home. You can dry your clothing and tell your story."
With that, the giant fisherman and his boy turned and walked away. Thomas opened his bag and pulled out the boots Stoch gave him. Then he slipped the bag over his shoulder and trotted down the pier in the direction of the dusty town beyond the warehouses.